Welcome to American Indian and Alaskan Native Living, a program designed to educate and inspire listeners throughout Indian country. American Indian and Alaskan Native Living is hosted by Dr. David DeRose, a board-certified specialist in both internal medicine and preventive medicine. Dr. DeRose has a wide range of experience with Native health issues, and he is here today to help you learn more about your health. Here is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome to American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. Today we've got a fascinating show lined up for you, and perhaps by way of introduction, it involves a professor at a major American university who's in the heart of Indian country and who has been known to step outside of his office door and shout out a solution to many health problems. You're wondering what those life-changing words might be? Well, you're in the right place. My guest today is Dr. Jay Sutliff. Jay, it's great to have you with us on today's show.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Jay, I introduced things with a rumor I've heard that you've been known to stick your head out your door and shout down the hall some words that are the keys to disease reversal. Is this really true or is it just some fabrication?
No, it's absolutely true. It's a regular occurrence on my end of the campus here.
So first of all, what campus are you on? And then we want to hear what that rallying cry is.
I am on the campus of Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, Arizona, a different part of Arizona than a lot of people experience. We're at 7,000 feet here. We have the majestic San Francisco peaks just right outside my office window here. So I'm in Northern Arizona.
It's a beautiful place. I've been up in your neck of the woods. I know a lot of First Nation peoples have roots in that part of Arizona, and hopefully some of them are actually tuning in today. You are a full professor there at the university in what discipline?
Okay, I've been at NAU for about 14 years. This is my 14th year at NAU, and I'm specifically in the Department of Health Sciences, and my discipline is nutrition and foods and public health.
So with that background, some folks might be starting to guess, well, what does this guy shout out his door? Well, what kind of, I mean, if he's got that kind of background, what are the words that people who especially are in proximity to you have heard multiple times?
Well, the gaping hole in a lot of our research and a lot of our things that are going on here is the food. It's about the food as a healing modality in all of our lifestyle aspects of health, wellness, mental health, the whole bit. So it's about I holler, it's the food, it's the food.
Okay, fair enough. And what I love about that cry coming from Arizona is years ago I was there in your state and had the privilege of rubbing shoulders with a lot of First Nation folks and was learning more about the Ho'okam people who, you know, have roots there, you know, predecessors of Tahana Adam and Gila River peoples there. And just hearing so much about the emphasis on food, how they valued the three sisters, kind of this almost, I don't want to say universal because there's a number of tribes that didn't really seem to have that ethic, but so many from the Northeast to the Southwest that talked about the three sisters, the corn, the beans, the squash, and just that native wisdom that seemed to be grounded in plant-based nutrition. Tell us, I mean, I know you work with all kinds of folks. I know you work with First Nation peoples up there, but from your perspective, as you talk with people about nutrition, do you find Indigenous peoples resonating with that message of whole plant foods?
Definitely segments of the population. I have a lot of Native First Nation students in my classes, and it seems like maybe their parents or grandparents are more in the traditional mindset and as far as diet in lifestyle. And it seems like when the students come to the campus, a large majority of them are still on their cell phones like the rest of the Western kids, and they're stopping at Taco Bell and some of the fast food restaurants. So they go home for the traditions and the lifestyle and the food. But it seems like when they step back off the reservation or come back to campus, they blend right in with the rest of them, with a lot of processed foods, a lot of sugary drinks, and, you know, the lifestyle. As we'll get into probably a little bit about the Blue Zones, how the distinctive behaviors and traditions that were so protective, health protective of First Nations and Native people years ago, really the transition has been very cumbersome and challenging.
No, it's a sad narrative. And of course, it's not the choice of First Nation peoples that they're in these environments. But let's just step back a couple of steps and try to make sure that my listeners know who you are. Folks that are in nutrition circles, research circles, read published literature, they know the name of Dr. Jay Sutliff. They know about your lab, the Prandial Lab there at Northern Arizona University. But let's go back long before that. And even though you're known in nutrition circles for your emphasis on some of these traditional lifestyle practices, the plant-based eating, this is not necessarily a normal trajectory for nutritionists. So how did you get interested in studying the benefit of these plant-based diets?
Okay, so I grew up in a typical Midwestern home up in North Dakota. Just
wow.
South of Winnipeg, Manitoba, just south of the Canadian border, North Dakota-Minnesota border. So I grew up in a typical Midwestern home where we had gardens and my grandparents farmed and we lived in town, but it was just a couple miles outside of town was the farm, and we'd go out there and hunt and fish. And so I grew up like the typical Midwestern kid who really, we didn't make much out about the food. We just ate basic plain foods. Mom made food basically every day, made at home. It was a treat to go out, those types of things occasionally. And growing up, I was a pretty active kid and outdoors and playing sports and things like that. And so my grandpa drilled into my head that I needed to get a formal college education. He didn't say what it would be. And I thought, well, I'll do wildlife management or I'll do landscape engineering. But I was a hockey player and I went to play. I went to play college hockey. And when I got there, you got to, you know, go back 40 years and nutrition, you know, we didn't have much labeling on packages and cereals and things like that. So we didn't know a lot. It wasn't a buzzword. But I thought there's got to be something with food and maybe my sports performance. And so I started pursuing that. I started looking at, well, can I improve my athletic performance by what I'm eating? And at the time, you know, I was eating basic foods and different things. And so I took a couple of classes in nutrition and I knew that that was the ticket for me.
Hmm.
And soon after that, I figured, well, I'm not going to make any money playing hockey. And so I got a job in a health club and started working with clients, got my professor a job as the head nutrition consultant at the health club. And all of us students would intern under our professor at the health club. And I studied dietetics. So that was my food, nutrition, dietetics. Technically, to be honest with you, Dr. DeRose, I have a degree in home economics.
Do you really? Interesting.
That's where nutrition was parked at the time.
Oh, yeah, exactly. No, I remember those days. So so a lot of people would have just thought you were just there to meet all the girls.
But, you know, I tell people I was in a cohort of 20 females and me, the only
yeah.
man. I graduated single, and I didn't know if that was telling on me or what that was. But I had to do a medical internship, a 9-month internship to become eligible to become a registered dietitian to write the boards. And so I went off to graduate school at the University of Nebraska, another Midwest, you know, agricultural college, and around a lot of dairy and a lot of cattle and different things like that. So I was even applying for jobs with the Nebraska Beef Council.
Okay.
And those types of jobs. And I was getting done with my master's degree and my dietetic internship were combined. And I was just about ready to graduate. And I thought, well, what am I going to tell my clients? It was always about the carbs. It was all about carbohydrates. And it was about protein and fat, all about the macronutrients.
Mm-hmm.
And you just had to just get the right formula, the 20% this and 30% that and higher this and lower that. And at the time, I was really going through also a kind of a personal exploration in my faith life. Well, you know, you're coming out of college and think about, you know, am I going to ever get married? Am I going to have a family? So I was just kind of evaluating all aspects of my life. And some people had shared some different books with me and I was studying different things and I started learning about the concept of clean and unclean foods and what that meant. And so I started looking at how animals, what their food supply was.
Mm-hmm.
What's an animal eat that we're eating? And when you look at some of the, what we're quote unquote unclean foods, like the bottom feeders of the rivers and stuff and catfish. And I'd fished catfish before and those types of things. Then you start looking at barnyard animals and I started looking at what were the unclean foods there? Who are the scavengers there? And so I started cleaning my diet up, so to speak.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was kind of the introduction to that. And then about that time, Dean Ornish, Dr. Dean Ornish.
Oh, sure.
Had dropped out of med school for a year to do the comprehensive cardiovascular trial.
Yeah, lifestyle heart trial. Yeah.
Yeah. The landmark back in the 70s, 80s. And so
uh-huh.
I started reading some of his material. And as you know, his was a, you know, unprocessed plant-based diet
mm-hmm.
for reversing heart disease. And there was a fair amount of that in my family tree.
Wow.
And I thought, well, is there some proof to this? And I was looking at what I was doing and I thought, you know what? I'm going to try that for 30 days. I was going to do a 30-day trial with one research participant myself.
Now, just let's stop. As a researcher, we always like to know what the baseline characteristics are before we hear about the intervention. So what were you eating before this, and how did you change your diet?
Okay, so I had started out with a fair amount of produce from the garden, but I was still into when you're an athlete, you're in college. I got a meal card, even though I lived off campus. I went and bought a meal pass so I could go to the all-you-can-eat salad bar, food bar, three times a day.
Okay.
Typical university food, lots of animal products, and lots of dairy. I was really into dairy.
Okay.
Couple times a day. And it was a contest. We would go in there as athletes, and when they call it an all-you-can-eat, that tells a guy like me that... that it's a contest.
Okay, fair enough.
But that's my baseline. And
okay.
then I was creeping along and I cut out quote unquote unclean foods, which, you know, different types of fish and seafood and different types of scavenger animal foods. And that's basically where I was at.
Maybe we should just pause here because some folks have heard this concept. Of course, the clean and unclean foods, this goes all the way back to the ancient Middle Eastern scriptures, right? Where they're talking about pigs being unclean and fish without fins and scales. And, you know, you didn't eat any camel or mice or anything like that. Those are all unclean. We get the picture, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah, so you're eating animal products, plenty of dairy. Yeah, lots of produce too. And you get this vision from Dean Ornish. You're going to try this. Basically, Ornish, I know at the time, I think he may have allowed a little skim milk or something, I think, in that first study, but you're going to go pretty much totally plant-based. Is that what you did?
You know, and this is 1991, 92, somewhere in there.
Okay.
90s. Yeah, and it wasn't like you could pull into your local grocery store and get some plant-based milk.
I'm going
from a gallon pretty much a day of milk, but I, you know, I had transferred from growing up with whole milk. I was now on skim milk.
Okay.
Skinless, boneless chicken. So I was following the guidelines that I was studying in my dietetic education. I was probably on the healthy end of that. So I didn't have any health complications. I didn't have any metabolic disorders, those types of things.
Right. You're healthy, but just want to try this out, see if it's going to make any difference.
Yeah, I thought, well, what difference am I going to feel with this Ornish program in 30 days?
Mm-hmm.
I'll give it a shot. And if this is something that I should teach my clients, I was only looking professionally first, to be honest with you. I wanted to see what it was like on me so I could teach my clients about whatever I felt was the best ideal diet.
So you got our interest. We're wanting to hear, first of all, I think I'm interested in hearing just how the diet was. I mean, for the first few days, for the first week, did you start saying, boy, do I got to keep doing this? I mean, was it a struggle?
Well, that's a great question because, you know, I really didn't know what I was doing. I went to a health seminar, and I think that's what a lot of times people don't do is that they make this wholesale change overnight.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really plan and prepare for it. So if you're gonna take something out, if I was taking all these foods out of my diet, what am I going to put in there? So you know what I would do? Here I am. It's kind of embarrassing. I was going to be a registered dietitian, and I'll tell you about the challenges there.
Okay, you have definitely got my interest. I'm sure you got many of our listeners' interest. And we want to hear about the first research study that Dr. Jay Sutliff did. It's on himself. Now, maybe I'm overstating it. Maybe you did some other research projects before that.
Nope.
But he is going to stick by because I don't know the conclusion of this story. I know he's still alive because he's my guest today. And if you think that's pushing an envelope, you definitely got to hear the story because it's coming up. I'm Dr. David DeRose. The show is American Indian and Alaska Native Living. We've got a lot more coming up in today's episode. Don't go away. More right after this.
Today's broadcast has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please reach out to us on the web at aianl.org. That stands for American Indian Alaska Native Living. Again, aianl.org. Or you can call us at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope. Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
When Jim died, I wondered if I would be able to keep the farm. Then I heard about the USDA's loan program for socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers. It's for women and minorities who may be having trouble getting credit. Once I was approved, the USDA's Farm Service Agency helped me get the credit I needed. Now I don't have to sell, and I can pass the farm down to my kids the way Jim's dad passed it down to him. I know he'd like that.
Contact your local USDA service center or visit www.fsa.usda.gov.
Social Security is with you through life's journey from birth to retirement. As your life changes year to year, so do your needs. For over 80 years, Social Security has helped to meet your needs and is committed to improving access to the services that make a difference in your life. Today, you can verify your earnings, estimate your future benefits, apply for retirement, manage your benefits, and even change your address, all from the comfort of your home. Social Security's online services help put you in control with secure access to your information anytime, anywhere, allowing you to spend more time with family, friends, or simply just enjoying the day. Social Security, securing today and tomorrow. See what you can do online at socialsecurity.gov.
Produced at U.S. taxpayer expense.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian and Alaska Native Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back to American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. My guest today is Jay Sutliff, PhD and registered dietitian. He's the director of the Prandial Lab and professor of nutrition and foods at Northern Arizona University. And I've been interested to learn some of the backstory on his research career. And Jay, just for the record, and perhaps even for the benefit of our listeners, as you've been telling about your background, I can relate. Me and my wife, our roots are also Midwest, Dakota. So my wife born in the Black Hills, and I was born in Chicago. I actually ended up doing some of my early educational work in Minnesota, Carleton College there outside of the Twin Cities in Minnesota. So we kind of know the lay of the land up there, and like a lot of folks who have some roots up there, I, you know, had my day on the ice rinks as well, playing hockey. I can tell already that you were a much more serious hockey player than me. When I was playing intramural hockey in Minnesota, you were with the big guys there. So I don't know if you don't look any worse for the wear. For those who are listening in today, we actually record many of our radio shows on Zoom. So I'm actually looking at Jay, and it looks like he's still got all his teeth, unlike some of the hockey players that I knew over the years. So anyway, Jay, I know looks can be deceiving. You don't have to give any confessions here, but I'm definitely interested in this story. So you're getting your nutrition training. You hear about the benefits of plant-based eating. Many of my listeners, if they are aware of some of the history of plant-based nutrition research, kind of cutting-edge stuff, Dr. Dean Ornish, 1990, I believe it was, the journal Lancet, the Lifestyle Heart Trial, showing that you could reverse blockages in heart arteries with a plant-based diet and a comprehensive lifestyle program that included a variety of components. But as you mentioned earlier, Jay, it's about the food. That was a huge part of it. So you're going to embark on this program, but we were kind of getting more of the backstory. You said, hey, I'm not going to just go into this willy-nilly. Before you went on this 30-day challenge, did you try to learn what you needed to do differently first?
Yeah, I did do that. I went to a weekend health seminar that included the cooking component, and which is, even with dietitians, a lot of us go into this nutrition field and we're excited about the metabolic components and the nutrient components. And some of us are allergic to the kitchen. A lot of my colleagues, they didn't want anything to do with the food service or the kitchen component. And I thought, well, I better go get a few culinary skills. So I got a little culinary skills and things like that. And I have to, I'm kind of embarrassed, but when I started the 30-day experiment, I thought, what am I going to eat? If you're taking something out of your diet, what are you going to fill that void with?
Right.
I would just go down. I would go into the grocery stores in Omaha, Nebraska, and I would just spend time in the produce aisle and thinking, I should know what this is or how to prepare it, but I don't. And I would just pick it up and take it home and I would try to cook it. Again, I was just cooking for myself and preparing meals for myself. So it wasn't a huge deal to adjust. And that's a big component. Maybe we'll talk about that, about your social circles and the people in your home. So for 30 days, I thought, well, I could do this for 30 days. And then I'll go back to, you know, I'll slowly bring in my skinless, boneless chicken and I'll bring in some skim milk and I'll gravitate. So as I was saying previously, I was a big dairy guy. I really liked that creamy texture. And I thought, what am I going to do? And you couldn't pull into the local grocery stores and buy a plant-based milk. And so there was a lady in Ralston, Nebraska, just outside Omaha. You had to go down the alley and take a right, knock on the door.
Oh, wow.
She had a little health food store out of the back of her house and she baked bread there. And I would go buy my milk. I almost feel like it was like an illegal transition. Driving down third house on the left, you know, that kind of thing. And so at the end of the 30 days, I thought, huh, I suddenly realized my clothes were fitting a lot looser. And I did not go after this for a weight loss. I was just going after it to how I feel, energy, you know, clarity of mind. And again, like I said earlier, I didn't have any complications. But at the end of the 30 days, I was a lot leaner. And I thought, well, that was pretty good. And I felt, well, I'm sleeping a little bit better. And sometimes I thought, well, I didn't sleep poorly, but I thought I've got mental clarity. And so I said, I'll do it for another 30 days.
Okay.
Then another 30 days and another 30 days. And just 5-6 days ago, I started another 30 days.
Wow.
So I just kept going with it because I thought this is really dynamite and I feel fantastic.
That is quite a testimony. And this is from somebody who's not just your average layperson. You're assessing this from the standpoint of nutritional adequacy and all that. Was that a stretch too? Were you a little, at that point, you know, there was, you know, questions, weren't there, about whether you'd be missing some things in your diet?
Yeah, in fact, I don't even know if we covered it much in my education about plant-based diets, or as they called them back then, vegetarian diets. We didn't spend much time on it. I don't remember covering more than a day on it because, you know, it was supposed to be so limited. Whenever you leave out food groups, it's suspect and you really have to be concerned about missing nutrients and things like that. Well, as I started diving into it, and then I started reading, you know, some of Dr. John McDougall's materials, and then I discovered Dr. Joel Fuhrman's materials, and I started looking at, you know, really there's buried research in the research journals back into the 40s and 50s about really how the adequate components are, maybe not in the Western world, but more, you know, even in, when you really look at really basic diets from years ago, even with First Nation people, I mean, that's the substance of the diet with very small amounts of animal products.
It really is amazing. I was just looking again, I was speaking to an audience about this. There's a book that was published, wow, it was a long time ago. It was called Diabetes as a Disease of Civilization. And one of the chapters was written by a native, I think Navajo researcher. And she was basically sharing the traditions throughout, not just Navajo Nation, but throughout the many First Nation peoples, like you mentioned, Jay, largely plant-based diets. And you go back and you look at some of these records from early Europeans who met Native Americans, and they're writing about these vast fields of cultivated produce. And we're not just talking the East Coast, we're talking the Midwest, we're talking the Southwest. Have you ever seen these older aerial photographs that show the remnants of irrigation canals throughout the Sonoran Desert? Have you ever seen those pictures?
Just a couple of them, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to think. People say, oh, well, how could Native Americans have had much plant-based eating and, you know, in Arizona? Well, they were irrigating large tracts of land before Europeans started diverting all the water. It's just an amazing story. So, yes, you're seeing this evidence in your own life. You're diving into the literature. You're seeing how there's this solid basis, you know, pointing us in the direction of more plant-based eating. And you really have become known for that kind of research and research circles. So how did that all go from a personal conviction to strong research interest?
Well, soon after my transformation of realization of really going back to basic foods, my point was, at that time, it was a realization that people needed to have access to food prepared, whole food, plant-based diet, and accessible. And so I felt the impression that I needed to start a restaurant and a bakery.
No way. Are you serious?
Yeah.
Really?
So, and I was single at the time. And suddenly, soon after that, I started doing some community seminars with a friend of mine who was a nursing professor at the University of North Dakota. And we started doing blood draws. And then we do like a 3-week intervention. You know, we use the word intervention loosely. Seminar. We did a 3-week seminar where we would collect blood draws at the beginning. We would do body fat. And she was a nursing professor. So we'd set up stations. And people would go around to these stations at the beginning and at the end. And in the middle, we would lecture on and talk about food preparation and the disease process. And we'd always have a big banquet at the end of how this food would taste and how we'd give them recipes. And the gal that we contacted that I felt I could, quote unquote, trust with my recipes was a local person as well. And soon after that, we got talking and she became my business partner and then eventually my wife.
Wow.
We started a restaurant, bakery, health food store in Grand Forks, North Dakota, right in the middle of the mecca of health.
Oh my, this is amazing.
So that was my hometown and I felt like giving back.
Uh-huh.
We did restaurants. We ended up having 3 different restaurants with bakeries and things like that. It was through that process where I saw people coming in and we would do weekend seminars and weekend and evening cooking classes. I saw the changes people were taking and making, and we got affiliated with a health retreat center in the Black Hills called the Black Hills Health and
Sure.
Education Center. And we saw people come in and in as little time as 3 weeks, we'd see people basically be de-prescribed their diabetic medication, their cardiovascular medications and things like that. When you give the body the proper setting and nutrients and stress reduction, the wonderful mechanism of the body will heal itself.
Love it. Love it.
Yeah. And so after working there for a while, I thought, I need to take this to the world. I want to go to a college campus and train the next generation and the next generation of healthcare providers so they can see firsthand what impact they can have getting an education. So I figured if I had 4 years with students, at least 2 years and maybe 4 years of them coming through a degree process, and I could have them on my research team and we would do practical application and they would see firsthand, they would grab this like I did, and then they would go on and make their career doing the same thing I was doing.
I love the story. I love the story. So this is an amazing background, Dr. Jay Sutliff. For those of you just joining us, he's not a stranger in nutrition research circles. PhD, registered dietitian, professor of nutrition and foods at Northern Arizona University. We're going to be looking at some very practical aspects of his research that can impact you, not just an amazing life story, but something that can change your life story. That's coming up in the second half of today's edition of American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. We've got a lot more to come. Stay by. We'll be right back after this.
American Indian and Alaska Native Living will continue in a moment. If you have questions or comments about today's pre-recorded broadcast, please contact us on the web at aianl.org or call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673.
A message from the National Police Association. It used to be that any able-bodied person would offer to assist a police officer in danger. Now, passersby are more likely to take a video. There's a better use for your phone when an officer's in trouble. Call 911. Tell the operator where you are and what you see. Then, start your video to provide evidence later. To learn more about how you can assist law enforcement, visit nationalpolice.org. That's nationalpolice.org.
Unlike other health concerns, mental illness is not always easy to see. Depression won't show up on an eye chart, and you can't measure it on your bathroom scale. Sorting out a mental health concern is not something to attempt on your own. You won't find a bipolar disorder by looking at a thermometer. Like many other health conditions, help for mental illness takes professional diagnosis and treatment. Anxiety won't just go away under a stick-on bandage. So the sooner you seek treatment, the better. If you or a loved one has a mental health concern, don't go it alone. Find out what to do. For 24-hour free and confidential information and treatment referral, call 1-800-662-HELP. Learn more at samhsa.gov/support. That's samhsa.gov/support.
Using meth taught me everything about freedom, only not like you think. It taught me how easy it is to lose your freedom. If you think meth is taking control of you, ask for help. You have the power to be truly free. I know. I'm Jan, and I'm free from meth.
If you or someone you know is struggling with meth, call 1-800-662-HELP for 24-hour free and confidential treatment referral. Learn more at samhsa.gov/meth.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian and Alaska Native Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back to the second half of today's edition of American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. I'm your host. My guest today, Dr. Jay Sutliff. He's a PhD and registered dietitian. He is the director of the Prandial Lab at Northern Arizona University. He's also a professor of nutrition and foods there. And before we get any more into the story, Jay, I just love the life history, the window on how you got into nutrition research. Obviously, you picked up your PhD along the way. Tell us a little bit, though, about the Prandial Lab. Folks hear that. I mean, if they're medical, they say, oh, Prandial, that refers to mealtime. But I think there's more to the name than just that.
Yeah. Whenever you have a quote-unquote research lab, people think it's based with beakers and goggles on and face mask and your pipettes and things like that. Well, my lab, so to speak, is a mobile lab where we go into the community and on the campus and into different areas of the community where we do what's called plant-rich and nutrient-dense interventions for active lifestyles. And that's basically an acronym, Prandial. And a colleague of mine is a acronym specialist. And he said, that's what you need to call your lab.
Okay.
And so it just has anything to do. And I involve my students, colleagues. We go out and we do blood draws and interventions and things like that. We do pre and post testing. And we just got done doing one 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
Where we take a lot of it is employee based, whether it's from the hospital here mm-hmm. or what's from employees here at the NAU. Or people from the community, we want to go in and try to, in a sense, help them and assist them in lifestyle change.
Excellent, excellent. I know one of the things that's gotten a lot of folks interested in looking more at comprehensive lifestyle has been this research that has come out under the heading of Blue Zones. Now, those who are regular listeners on our show have heard some of my other guests speak about Blue Zones, but for those who may have heard the term, maybe they've never heard it, what just is a blue zone?
Okay. Yeah, so back in 2005, I was teaching in Chatter, Nebraska, Western Nebraska, and a colleague of mine walked across the hallway and said to me, have you seen this yet? And it was a copy of the National Geographic magazine, and on the cover, it said The Secrets of Living Longer. Mm. And Dan Buettner, a world explorer, and his brother went around, and they discovered these pockets of people in different regions in the world where they're living with vitality into their 100th year, and they call them centenarians. And they teamed up with some demographers, people studying demographics and things like that, epidemiologists. And my understanding, I always thought, well, why do they call them blue zones? Well, these demographers would have these big maps on the wall, and they'd putting a dot there in birth and death, lifespan. They were looking, and they were finding pockets of people that were living to be 100 years old with vitality. And they put a dot on the board, and all of a sudden, then they would take a big blue magic marker, and they would circle those zones. This is my understanding. They would circle those zones, and it was a blue marker, and they circled them, and they called them blue zones. And so they suddenly found there was three clusters in the world. First one was Sardinia, Italy, a little island off of the mainland of Italy on Europe there. And then another one was in Okinawa, Japan. And the third one, of all places, was in North America, United States, on the West Coast in Loma Linda, California. And they found these pockets of people who were living to be 100 years old with vitality. And then they started looking at, well, what do they have in common? Obviously, they're from very different genetic gene pools.
Sure, yeah.
You got Europeans, you have Asians, and you have, you know, Western Americans. And they suddenly realized that it had a lot of lifestyle factors in common. And being a nutritionist and dietitian, I really found that fascinating, because the dietary component is huge, a huge component of why they feel these populations were living so long and so well. And obviously it had to do with social aspects, spiritual aspects. I mean, coming from very different faith communities, very different social dynamics, but living with vitality. And it's interesting, you know, I've been trained to tell people you need to go to the gym this many days a week for this many minutes. You have to eat this many servings of this and this many grams of that. A lot of these blue zone people, they're just living life. They're just living life very simply. And then they discovered since then two more blue zones. One happens to be in Icaria, Greece, so another European one. And then another one in Central America in Costa Rica. So they've discovered these zones, and what they've really found is that it's the complete package deal of the lifestyle with a strong nutrition component, which I grab onto. And it's ironically, my wife grew up, was born at Loma Linda Sanitarium back in the day. So that's why I had another vested interest in, because I call my wife Blue Zone Chloe.
Okay.
She grew up in the blue zone, and she didn't know she was in a blue zone.
Good deal.
She was living life and living a simple life. And it's ironic that here in Flagstaff, I met a real good friend of mine now, Tony, and he's a Navajo person. And he said that growing up, there was a word in the Navajo language, and I don't know how to pronounce it. It says live to be 102 years old. And so that's kind of ironic. And so his goal was, when he discovered the Blue Zone National Geographic and things like that, that's how I crossed paths with him. And we're still working on the idea of implementing different types of lifestyles back into the Navajo Nation here, just outside Flagstaff, and trying to slowly bring back the old Navajo ways into the current generation and try to create again a blue zone. And ironically, I'm supposed to have a meeting in a week or two. The former Navajo Nation president, Jonathan Nez, is really wanting to push this as well. He really thinks getting back to the lifestyle of the traditional ways is the way to go, as far as longevity, the diabetes, and different things like that.
I love the history. I mean, throughout Indian country, it's fascinating, as I talk with people from multiple tribes. The history, the oral history, is no diabetes prior to European contact. And, you know, you've got a fascinating partnership there in your general neck of the woods there in the Phoenix area, where there's data going back over 100 years to folks on the Gila River Reservation with virtually no diabetes. I mean, I think the oldest data I've seen goes back around 1900, and I think there's one case out of 4,000 people with diabetes. So even in the, you know, more recent quote-unquote history, seeing this resilience of Native people when it comes to diabetes, but then compare that with where we're at today. And I think a lot of my listeners know that there's been some incredible strides made in Indian country, especially Native researchers, Native health professionals, helping to turn back some of the clock on diabetes. You're seeing some very good things in Indian country. But yeah, a lot of folks, like the Navajo friend you mentioned, saying we need to return to our Native roots. So let's pick up on that theme because, you know, we've been talking a bit about this plant-based eating. Was that really a part of the Blue Zone diets? Were these populations eating lots of plant foods?
Yes, yeah. And so it's plant predominant. We wouldn't necessarily label them as vegans, mm-hmm. you know, total plant-based, but predominantly unprocessed foods. And the big ones seem to be legumes or beans, peas, lentils, those types of things, you know, at least a half a cup to a cup a day. And, you know, right away, we want to measure everything and talk about grams. And we're like, just eat some beans every day, mm-hmm. you know, get some grapes into your diet and things like that. And just eat greens right from the land and reduce your stress, get out and move around. And like I was saying, I mean, we used to tell people you have to exercise this many minutes at this, your heart rate and things like that. People weren't joining health clubs in these blue zones per se.
Right.
They're active and they're lifting stuff and they're moving and they're cardiovascularly fit. And I would say too, that most of them are in more temperate climate. Mm. They're not extreme climate, but their family connections are unreal too.
Mm.
The family connections and the friendship and the social connection and slowing down and sharing meals with people and those types of things.
Well, I know one thing that's getting folks' attention, you know, you mentioned this common factor between your own lifestyle journey and these blue zones, and that was more plant-based diet. And you observed that you were trimming down some. And I know that's a topic that's getting a lot of interest today. Why would more plant-based eating actually help someone in that department?
You know, the big thing that I'm finding here too is that we tend to eat what we call a calorie dense diet, typically processed foods. You get more calories per bite. And, you know, a lot of people will focus on, does this have carbohydrates? Does this have fat in it? How much protein in there? And I've really seen through the, you know, 30 some years that I've been studying nutrition, 40 years, I guess, is that really it comes back down to nutrient density. How many nutrients are you getting per bite? You know, the phytochemicals, the antioxidants, the colorful, rich foods is really where you get the greatest bang for your buck. And so when you start looking at it and the research that we've done, that if a person can have a big green leafy salad every day, you know, dark greens, also adding in the cabbage component and the cruciferous vegetables. And, you know, we talked a lot about fruits and vegetables and things like that. And people say, yeah, yeah. And then you start looking at the berry content of the diet and you start looking at the seed content of the diet. A colleague of mine, my research partner is Dr. Joel Furman, and he coined the phrase G-bombs. Greens, beans, onions, mushrooms, berries, and seeds.
Okay.
So you try to get a G-bomb every day. And we do cooking classes where you do G-bomb recipes. And so really we've pivoted the focus away from the macronutrients, the carbohydrate, the protein, and the fat. And we focus more on the micronutrient density of the diet. And so when you start doing that, the body just naturally gravitates to a body weight and a body fat level that you would operate best for your genetic makeup.
Mm. I love that perspective on weight, you know, rather than looking at arbitrary numbers, basically saying, hey, start living a more optimal lifestyle and your weight will equilibrate at what is ideal based on your genetics, your early life history, whatever determinants are there.
That's right.
So I love that picture. And that's what you're seeing in your research, I'm understanding.
Absolutely. Yeah. People always want us to weigh every week. Like we do an 8-week seminar intervention or a 12-week or whatever length we're doing. People keep saying, are we going to weigh every week when we come in? We're like, no, your body's going to adjust and gravitate to up or down or where it needs to be. And really, we're looking at really how much visceral fat we store, you know, right around the belt line. And that's kind of that fat you can't really pinch. It's kind of underneath the surface. You know, we've got the subcutaneous fat like a submarine just underneath the surface. Mm-hmm. And then we've got the visceral fat that's around our vital organs. And literally just 2 weeks ago, we finished a 4-week study. I'm teaching an undergraduate class in nutrition research. And I thought, rather than talk about the theories of research, let's actually go out and do one.
Oh, wow.
And students got excited. And we have a plant-based group that meets once a month in town here. And so we took people from there and friends they had. And we looked at just going nutrient-dense foods. And we had a machine that we could measure the visceral fat content. And it's dramatically coming down. So their risk factors are dramatically coming down. and eating rich foods, or, you know, not rich foods, but just eating very plentiful amounts of foods, mm-hmm. and just eating and enjoying and not weighing and counting carbs and uh-huh. all these different grams of fat, just eating whole foods, unprocessed foods, and just enjoying them and changing the taste buds.
Wonderful stuff. What we're talking about here, powerful message that's talking about disease reversal, helping people trim down. We want to talk more about some of the practical aspects of this and talk about some of the challenges that people might face if they try to embark on that same journey that you did, Dr. Sutliff. I'm Dr. David DeRose. Dr. Jay Sutliff is my guest. We're speaking about the power of plant-based nutrition, making a difference in your life and the life of those you care about. Our final segment will be focused on just that, practical considerations, other things you may want to think in terms of if you've got other lifestyle challenges, other health challenges, might a dietary change be something special for you? That's all coming up in our final segment. Don't go away.
Today's broadcast has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
If a natural disaster comes knocking, how prepared is your family? You can't just close the door on earthquakes, floods, or hurricanes and hope they go away. That's why it's important to make a plan now. Ready.gov/plan has the tools and tips you need to prepare your family for an emergency. So if disaster shows up at your doorstep, you'll be ready. Visit ready.gov/plan and make a plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
I'm just texting him back.
I'm just posting a story.
I'm just changing the song.
I'm just...
No. When it comes to distracted driving, just don't. Sending a text takes your eyes off the road for just 5 seconds, but in that time, your car can travel the length of an entire football field. Any distracted driving just isn't worth it.
Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
What is a number story?
My number story started with fear and a lack of support, and it has led me to be there for others.
A number story begins in our childhood with ACEs, adverse childhood experiences.
My number story begins with the separation from my father and the emotional abandonment from my mother, and leads to me being a role model to not only myself, but those around me by becoming the person that wasn't there for me.
ACEs are so common, 2/3 of us have one.
My number story begins with drug abuse and homelessness, and leads to realizing that I can live life by my own standards.
A study found the more ACEs, the more likely we may experience a host of serious health effects, physical and mental, but that doesn't need to be the case. Your ACE number is simply an entry point to your own story. Where it leads is up to you.
My number story begins with years of emotional abuse, and leads to peace, clarity, and security in my self-worth.
Take control of where your number story leads at numberstory.org.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian and Alaskan Native Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back for our final segment of American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. Dr. Jay Sutliff, he is my guest. If you're just joining us, he's a PhD and registered dietitian. He's the director of the Prandial Lab and professor of nutrition and foods at Northern Arizona University. Jay, it's been really great to be dialoguing with you. We've been enjoying learning about your own life journey that's impressed you with the power of plant-based eating, now doing research on those topics. You know, one of the issues that comes up a lot in my work as an internal medicine specialist, I still spend a little bit of time in the clinic each week, and I have a lot of folks who are struggling with substances. And this is a big issue in just about every demographic. It's not, of course, a native issue specifically, although people throughout Indian country, of course, are affected just like every other population segment. And one of the questions that I think a lot of people are asking is, does, you know, a more plant-based diet, you know, hold any promise if someone's trying to break free of, you know, alcohol or addictive drugs? Do we have any insight into that?
Well, it's interesting. We did do a study with a treatment center down in Austin, Texas, a few years ago with a graduate student I had. And what we found there is we offered a complete whole food plant-based diet to different segments of the treatment audience there. And what we found there, even though the numbers were kind of small because of COVID hit during that time and so forth, was a little bit complicated. But from our own personal research, we found that putting people on a nutrient-dense plant-rich diet, a real nutrient-dense, we find that a lot of people that are involved in the substance use tend to be nutrient deficient. And so we started providing the proper nutrients for the brain function and for the whole metabolic system in the body. That seems like the inflammatory markers came down and it became what we call neuroprotective, where we felt like the brain processes with the omega-3 fatty acids coming from the greens and the walnuts and the flax seeds and different things like that. It seems like we built up that internal mechanism with the body and also brought down the inflammatory markers. And the thing you'll find out too, as you know, Dr. DeRose, is that it's a low stimulant diet. And so really these reward systems in the brain, and specifically the dopamine reward system, is brought down to a more manageable level. And when you're not using heavily processed foods and sweeteners and things like that, it helps balance out blood sugar levels, neuroprotective factors, and then also has to do with that reward system. And so we found that really it could be helpful as a major component in addition to counseling and therapy and things like that, is the dietary component, inflammatory and nutrient-dense foods.
So in that preliminary study, you were really looking at markers that indicated that this theoretically would be of benefit long-term, but it wasn't like you followed these people for 5 years and found they were less likely to go back to substance use or anything like that.
No, and the funding agency for the project had gone through that process himself and is now taking that further himself, Adam Sudd. And we just did a pilot, and it didn't turn out the way we wanted to as far as length of time because of the COVID. Patients weren't coming in as much. And then I've looked at other people's work too as well. And it just seems like when you get people proper nutrients and you bring the inflammatory markers down, specifically the high sensitivity C-reactive protein marker in the blood and different things like that, and you basically balance out, and you're not doing the blood sugar control seems to be a huge component too. So I see people who are not in good blood sugar management and maybe pre-diabetic or insulin resistant, that gets them into that cycle too. And it seems like a cluster of people with substance abuse and poor metabolic control. The processed food seems to really get them on that roller coaster ride. So when you stabilize that with the whole foods, it seems to be positioning people for a better outcome as far as substance use.
Tremendous. Well, let's just talk about some of the most practical stuff at the end here. So folks have been listening, if they haven't heard the message already, eating more of these whole plant foods doesn't mean they have to just eat the broccoli out of the garden raw. They can use it in recipes and things, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we think personally what we've seen in our studies is that the hardest meal of the day a lot of times is the midday meal. And so we're looking at if someone could pack a green leafy salad and then throw in there I like to throw in chickpeas. I like to throw other types of legumes or beans, whatever, or maybe a salad wrap in a wrap, like a burrito, so to speak, putting your burritos in there and stabilizing the blood sugars. Obviously, breakfast is important too, but typically breakfast and the end of the day, if people are eating a three-meal pattern like that, those are a little bit more, well, easily prepared, but the middle of the day, being able to pack a lunch where you're taking a green leafy vegetable salad with you, something like that with some legumes, something with some substance in there, maybe some whole grains in there, some Ezekiel bread or something of that nature. And then throwing in some, I always like to throw in at least one serving of cruciferous vegetables a day. And it doesn't have to be a big serving. I mean, Brussels sprouts and things like that.
So help us get that down. I mean, you and I, you know, we work in this world. So cruciferous vegetables, you know, I could give you a list too, but you probably have a longer list than me. So let our listeners know, what are some of the cruciferous vegetables?
Any of your cabbages, like maybe making a coleslaw or a salad with some type of that in there, maybe it kale's a cruciferous vegetable, Brussels sprouts, maybe steamed Brussels sprouts. So throwing those in, and it doesn't take a lot of them. And then maybe even throwing in some mushrooms or things like that.
So cruciferous vegetables also include, you mentioned Brussels sprouts, but also broccoli, cauliflower. Is that right?
Correct. Exactly. Yeah.
And if they're more Asian diets, bok choy, that will work?
100%. Yeah. So, hey, stir fry.
Okay.
The stir fry with the bok choy and the broccoli and the cauliflower. Absolutely.
Okay. So why are you emphasizing this particular group of plant foods?
Okay, these specific foods are the most cancer-protective foods on the planet.
Mm.
So we have different active ingredients in those cruciferous vegetables that really protect against cancer. And I see, you know, you start looking at the dramatic increase of cancer.
Mm.
Just take care of it. Do a serving a day of cruciferous vegetables. Get some broccoli, get some cauliflower, get some bok choy, get some kale, and change your taste buds. Make a little salad dressing and put it on there.
Okay, we got it. So any other pitfalls? Folks, they're leaving this show, they say, hey, I'm going to try this 30-day challenge. Are you worried that you haven't shared some information that's going to, you know, undermine their success?
Yeah, typically the male species undermine a lot of health programs and things like that. A lot of people that will respond to us are basically women who are caring for families or loved ones. Your social circles, who's around you, planning ahead and not having people sabotage your plan, having a strong will to stick with it. Those are some major aspects as well.
Let me ask you another question, because this is coming close to home. I've got a daughter who's pregnant, and I know a lot of times women, they have such legitimately concerns about, you know, having a healthy baby. Someone might be at that stage right now listening and they're saying, well, I don't want to go on a plant-based diet, this could hurt the pregnancy. Is there any reason they should be concerned in that arena?
That's funny you ask that. So interestingly enough, we took a segment of women that we were studying over a three-year period of time that actually had a pregnancy and delivered a baby during our research study.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that the women, we interviewed them. I had a graduate student call up those pregnant women and interview them how their pregnancy went. And overwhelmingly, they had a much easier pregnancy. Those who had a pregnancy before claim that they had a better pregnancy when they're on a nutrient-dense, whole food, plant-based diet. And a lot of them comment, and this was a surprise to me, that when they were not relying on as many animal products, that they actually produced a more adequate amount of milk, breast milk.
Oh, interesting.
They were overgorged. Is that the term? Is that the tip?
Well, I'm an internal medicine specialist. So when you start talking about pregnancy, we're treading on thin ice.
They actually found that they were producing a more adequate supply of breast milk when they were nutrient-dense, whole food, plant-based.
That is very interesting.
Yeah. And the complications and the morning sickness and things like that was much, much reduced.
Wow.
When they were following a more nutrient-dense diet as well.
Well, so is there anyone that should be very cautious before they embrace a more plant-based eating style?
I think if you're intelligent about it and you're not just cutting out food groups and not replacing them with something. A lot of times people too will do a plant-based diet and then they'll eat a lot of processed foods.
Okay.
Just because it doesn't have animal products doesn't mean it's necessarily healthy.
I get it.
Yeah. And so, and I mean, there's some nutrients. I mean, we want to make sure that they're getting a wide variety of colorful, rich fruits and vegetables and leafy greens and legumes every day.
So Jay, you've done a lot of great work, research. I know you've got a lab there, Northern Arizona. If someone wanted to learn more about you, just do a literature search, or is there some place to go? Where do you point folks if they say, hey, I want to see some of your research?
They can Google me and also look at the nau.edu website. And I'm on there under Jay Sutliff, and it lists all my work and how they can get a hold of me, email and so forth. Yep.
Okay. So as long as we can remember Northern Arizona University, nau.edu, and Jay Sutliff, we should be in business, huh?
Yeah, not hard to find, yeah.
Jay, hey, thank you so much for pulling away from all that research and those students. We really appreciate you sharing your life story and your research interests.
Dave, my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you to you, each of my listeners, for joining us on today's edition of American Indian and Alaska Native Living. As always, I'm Dr. David DeRose, wishing you the very best of health.
Native Voice One. The Native American Radio Network.